Hey, thanks for spending time with me. Rusnowski here. This is Porchlight. Allow me to invert this ancient joke, likely based on a real-life encounter somewhere in Midtown Manhattan. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? The lost visitor asked. Practice, the stranger replied. Thus, the inverse. How do you get to practice? Well, the directions to your destination will involve devoting plenty of time, although along the way an excellent teacher may offer you a lift. And probably at some point in your journey of discovery, you will pass the intersection of curiosity and forgiveness. By practicing anything, you will occasionally fail. If this is done in the company of others, you might be corrected, though hopefully not shamed. Some may be generous enough to offer you forgiveness for your mistakes. This can easily be translated into encouragement. The curiosity becomes your motivation to continue practicing until that skill gradually becomes part of your identity. Carnegie Hall notwithstanding, there is no final destination with practice. That's why doctors and spiritual seekers describe their vocations in this way. With practice, not giving your actions a second thought might seem like the objective, but your many memories of what it took to achieve any mastery you've acquired make this unlikely. They will sweep you right past that second thought to maybe that 10,000th step, not all of them moving forward. Eventually, if you've been practicing anything long enough, you might actually begin to look like what you're doing. Witness airline pilots, each exhibiting a calm demeanor from managing all those essentials, along with a good posture, in spite of sitting down for thousands of miles a day. Just watch them at the airport. Whatever the estimated time of departure, they're never flustered. They're never in a rush. They know you won't be leaving until they do. One more example of a successful practitioner of practice. A large limestone building, constructed in 1905 with a grand entry of 21 steps. At the very top, a toddler of between 1 and 2 with dad holding both her hands above her head. By the time she had descended halfway, she had already drawn an appreciative crowd of onlookers. Sure, a great lesson in courage and perseverance. Pretty soon, I imagine she'll be practicing with only one hand being held. But the real gift when she nailed that final step was watching her clap and giggle in sheer delight. So how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, but also make sure and enjoy the walk.
All the tricks that you used on me. You're reading all them high fashion magazines. The clothes you're wearing, girl, are causing public scenes. I said, I'm not your stepping stone. I'm not your stepping stone. Not your stepping stone. Met your girl, you didn't have no shoes, but now you're walking around like your front page news. You've been awful careful about the friends you choose, but you won't find my name in your book of who's who's. I said, I'm not your stepping stone.
No, girl, not me. your stepping stone. I'm not your stepping stone. Not your stepping stone. Not your stepping stone. Not your stepping stone. Not your stepping stone.
Woke up this morning, the house was cold. Checked the furnace, she wasn't burning. Went out and hopped in my old Ford. Hit the engine, but she ain't turning. Giving each other some hard lessons lately. We ain't learning. We're the same sad story, that's a fact. One step up and two steps back. Girl and wine inside a church in June, but the church bells ain't ringing. I'm sitting here in this bar tonight, but all I'm thinking is I'm the same old story, same old fact. One step up and two steps back. It's the same thing night on night. Who's wrong, baby, who's right? Another fight and I slam the door on. Another battle in our dirty little war. When I look at myself, I don't see the man I wanted to be. Somewhere along the line, I slipped off track. Moving one step.
Yes, kids are easily distracted and quite often sensitive to correction. That can be a challenge in developing a sustained practice, but kids also possess perhaps the most valuable asset for learning something difficult, and that's resilience. Their physical resilience, which can come in handy with, say, ice skating. Mental resilience, which is essential for mastering a second language, and also theirs is a resilience that can be quickly restored by an unbounded sense of humor. My guest on this party of two, Paul Swain, has tried and succeeded and failed countless times over numerous endeavors throughout his life. We will discuss a small sample of his practices here. There will be some sound advice shared, but I also invite you to listen between the lines for the lessons that cannot be expressed in words. Notice, for instance, how often you'll hear Paul laugh. I wanted to start just with the whole idea of practice and the steps involved. How, for instance, you get invited. I know that you're skilled in many different areas. Darts, law school, reading, literature, golf. You've taken apart automobile engines and put them back together.
I've done that.
So there are a lot of skill sets there.
Yeah.
I want to pick up on two of them. One would be the law.
Okay.
How you were channeled into law school.
So there I was, my junior year with really, well, what are you going to do with this wonderful degree? I don't know. So some buddies, they had been planning on being lawyers basically from the time that they were zygotes, because it was what their parents had wanted, right? They are getting all hyped up about the LSAT. So I thought, well, hell, I don't have anything better to do. Why don't I just plunk down my $20 and give this thing a shot? And so I did, and I did surprisingly well. That's how that happened.
As you know, a lot of individuals perseverate over the LSATs. They'll pay to take classes for preparation.
Yep.
They'll study past tests, and they're still agonized on the day of the test.
Yep. The day that I went in, my attitude was, well, this is just one of many avenues that I'll pursue. I didn't really have anything vested in it. My two buddies, however, they had been talking about it from the time that I first met them to 2 years later, and they were so hyped up about it that neither one of them did very well.
But you won't. No, you won't. 'Cause I can't make you love me. If you
I want to ask you about golf. This is a fascinating subject to me because I don't play personally, but I've known many individuals who I think have a pretty steady continence, a center of gravity, if you will.
Okay.
And they become incredibly frustrated playing golf. And you perhaps have had friends like this as well.
Oh, I'm one of them.
Could you explain this to me? Could you tell me about how you discovered the game and then your overall experience with the game?
There's a friend of mine. We were playing darts one night, just having big old fun. We decided to partner up, and we're taking on and beating all comers. And after we were done, he says to me, you know, the way you play darts and your hand-eye coordination, I think you love this game. Are you kidding me? There was a time when I'd rather watch paint dry, grass grow. He says, no, you should try it. And I go, okay. So he takes me out on the course, and of course I'm absolutely miserable. I mean, I'm having fun, but I'm horrible at it because I haven't had any lessons. And it's the whole thing of making this ball go somewhere by hitting it with this stick. Well, this is not like pool. One could pick easier pursuits, in other words. There's a lot of moving parts. The hand-eye coordination is one, and just the ability to stay within yourself and not let the frustration of it impact the way that you're playing the game and the way that you're carrying out getting from tee to the green and ultimately the little white hole. Even though I was aggravated as hell that first time out, I thought, this is a challenge. I would really like to be able to do this. What's to not like? You're walking in beautiful sunshine. You got birds chirping around you. You got nothing but forest and water hazards and...
Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Just don't move me the way that it should. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. There ain't no book you can read. There ain't nobody to tell you. But I don't think I'm getting what everyone's getting. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Sometimes I throw off a good one. At least I think it is. No, I know it is. I shouldn't be thinking at all. I shouldn't be thinking at all. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Just don't move me the way that it should.
That is, in many ways, a representation of the challenges that we face every day in life. Because there are going to be inevitable frustrations, many of them unexpected, that draw us away from our consciousness of the beauty of this world. You've played some remarkable courses, not only in terms of the challenges they present, the hazards, the length, but also how they are consciously designed.
Right.
I want to talk about one that a lot of excellent golfers haven't had the chance to play, and that would be the Pete Dye design course down in French Lick, West Baden.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about what makes that course particularly challenging, particularly fascinating to you? How did you decide at some point, this is something I've got to do?
When you play a Pete Dye course, there's certain holes that stick in your memory. He's making the green and his fairway design be accommodated by the surroundings, the geography. He's taking advantage of that, and he's incorporating it into his design. But at the same time, he's also doing things that make you think, this guy is either a sadist or he's got a really great sense of humor about the game of golf. Because you find yourself on these greens with these incredible putts and just facing these incredible rolls and things that you would never expect to happen. And if you walked away from there with less than three putts, somebody was smiling on you that day because it was outrageous. I thought, well, your skill level is enough. Otherwise, you wouldn't have felt comfortable coming down here. So you'll be all right. Just stay in yourself and play your game. You had that shot. You screwed it up. That shot's done. That hole's done. Now you've got the next one. Can you get back in your rhythm? Can you get back in the mindset? As hard as it may be to adapt that as a practice, the quicker that you're able to do it, the better off your game will be.
How did you do on the Dye course?
Oh, I embarrassed my family and friends, but I had fun.
Did you see that?
Miracle, eh?
Nice shot, Bishop. You must have made a deal with the devil.
Yeah, I could break the club record, theoretically.
You better come in until this blows over.
Funny, isn't it, Claude?
I keep playing. I don't think the heavy stuff's going to come down for quite a while.
You're right. Anyway, the good Lord would never disrupt the best game of my life.
Four.
Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just a wee bit. And that's when my caddy lost sight of it. That little white pellet has never been found to this day. But it went straight down the middle, like they say. Back down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way. The sun was never brighter, the greens were never greener, and I was never keener to play. I heard it ping down the middle, it went zing down the middle. Oh, the life of a golfer is not all gloom. There's always the lies in the locker room. And I'm in my glory when wrapped in a towel I say that it went straight down the middle today. Of a golfer is not all gloom, though they charge you for listening in the locker room. but I'm in my glory when wrapped in a towel I say that it went straight down the middle. Where it wound up is a riddle, but it went straight down the middle.
For this postcard home, the postmark reads Lakeside, Ohio. Childhood, as a distinct phase of human existence, is actually a fairly recent concept. In pre-industrial societies, children were often regarded as economic assets once they survived infancy. Essentially, if you were old enough to spend time unsupervised, you were old enough to manage simple tasks, like picking wild berries or scattering seed for the chickens. Not that industrialization would change this perception much. If there was actual money to be paid and made, a pre-adolescent working outside the home might contribute to their upkeep. Between 1890 and 1910, a fifth of all American children between ages 10 and 15 were employed in cotton mills, mines, and factories. As compulsory school attendance and child labor laws emerged in the late 1930s, an effort was made to create resources to help fill the leisure time of childhood. This led to the proliferation of playgrounds, amusement parks, and in certain towns across America, miniature golf courses. But as soon as the post-war baby boom flattened out and large suburban tracts became valuable, many of these enterprises would simply vanish. Exceptions were found within the exceptions. Lakeside, Ohio was one of the original Chautauqua communities, founded in 1873 as a summer gathering place for spiritual and intellectual growth. Their miniature golf course would become the latest iteration of shuffleboard and croquet. To quote the reverse of the color postcard, relaxing activity amidst beautiful flowers and shrubs in tree-shaded Central Park overlooking Lake Erie. Okay, it isn't Palm Beach or Myrtle Beach, but at least the lake won't constitute a potential water hazard. A phone call to reserve tea time is probably unnecessary, although it will inform you that the price for one round at Lakeside is a mere $4, putter included. Cheaper than the Pete Dye course. Hey, cheaper than a cup of coffee. But don't assume this is simply golf dumbed down for kids. If you can manage to shoot par, send me your scorecard. And remember, if you're over 12, no mulligans. Hey, nice to be with you. You're listening to Porchlight with Tom Rusnowski.
Well, I started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone, and the sun went down as I crossed the hill, and the town lit up. The world got still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing. Well, the good old days may not return, and the rocks might melt, and the seed may burn. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing. Say life will beat you down and break your heart, steal your crown. So I've started out for God knows where. I guess I'll know when I get there. Fly around the clouds, but what goes up must come down. Thing. I'm learning to fly around the clouds, but what goes up must come down. I'm learning to fly. I'm learning.
Thank you. summer I did swan dives and jackknives for you all. And once when you were looking, I did a cannonball, did a cannonball. This summer I went swimming, this summer I might have drowned. But I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around, moved my arms around.
While the decision to begin or sustain any practice remains personal, the process will almost inevitably intersect with other lives and similar passions. That steady repetition of once again becomes cyclical over time. The edges round out, and you can really start to roll. If you encounter a slope on part of your journey, you'll cover more distance with less effort. Then at some point in your experience, you may be called upon to become that other for someone else. You realize just how much you've been taught, and so you teach.
I and my brother and sister were lucky to have a mother that thought that reading was really important. She used to read to us, and I would read to my younger brother and sister as well. And I loved reading, as it turns out. The house was just filled with books. And we were encouraged to go to the library. And one of the things I wound up realizing is, this is fun. This is where your imagination can just go wild and you can be taken wherever the writer wants to take you. And you can learn stuff despite yourself. You're reading about Henry and the rocket ship and somehow you find out that there are 9 planets. Whoa, well, there were at the time anyway. But I've never lost the thrill of reading. I love reading.
I think whenever you're in a position that you are, where you've had these experiences, frustration, excitement, there's always a question about whether you prefer to be in a position to be a student or teach. With regard to what you've accumulated in terms of knowledge and experience, are you still willing or still interested in being a student or being a teacher?
Well, I think I sort of satisfied that itch years ago, Tom. I coached Boys and Girls Club soccer for about 7 years, and that is probably as close to teaching as I'm ever going to get. And that was fun. That was enjoyable, because to watch these kids when they get it, I mean, you see that bulb go off. It's almost literal. And when they get it, it's wonderful. We practice maybe 2-3 times a week. And this particular season, these kids went undefeated. I mean, it was amazing. They were so thrilled. I think one of the parents put one of the little girls up to bringing me flowers, and they bowled me over. I swear to God, I was almost in tears. It was so much fun, man. But teacher or student, I think I prefer to be a student because I'm more of a sponge. If it sounds like something that I can internalize, or something that might have some practical application, I'm all there.
You see me standing on the bridge. field looks colorful to me. Made it through the winter time. Made it through the spring. Made it through the summer and the fall.
I see that. Mm-hmm. Fairly nice looking piece. Can you hit anything?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Hit that. No, son. I just want to know, can you shoot your piece?
Move?
What the hell you mean move?
I'm better when I move.
Yeah.
A small framed portrait, a lighted candle, corner shrine for one Billy Leonard. I knew him as Uncle Billy, though truth be told, I did not know him well. He was a great uncle on my father's side, my grandmother's kid brother, essentially. That entire generation of siblings had stayed put in Syracuse, New York all their lives, probably because throughout their young adulthoods, Syracuse was thriving as much as any city in America. Innuendo, if not outright mystery, had always infused that particular limb of the family tree. My Aunt Eleanor, the youngest, had become pregnant in her early teens. No committed partner, no chance that Eleanor could raise the infant herself, so the eldest daughter, Florence, took responsibility for parenting. In time, this child became Beverly Keene, my godmother. Ever since discovering this secret as an adult, I have deeply admired my parents for extending that kind invitation to Beverly. Uncle Billy's early life was captivating as well. All I knew as a boy was that Billy had at one time been a prize fighter. A short period of time, I surmised, since at 60-some, Billy looked nothing like the young man in the posed photograph hanging in Billy's modest home. That studio portrait was grandly framed and hung at the turn of the stairs, so Billy would consult it at the close of every day. Our family would visit that home at Christmas time. Billy and his beloved wife, Connie, were cheerful hosts. Aluminum Christmas tree, strong Polish horseradish. I'd always catch a glimpse of Billy's trim former self at the turn of the stairs. I asked my grandfather about it, which led to the only other reference to this legend I ever heard. Billy stepped out of his corner for round one, and his opponent said, "Hey, Mac, your shoelace is untied." A story with a good punchline, you might say. Recently, my brother shared an internet link that revealed the true picture and the real story. Someone had actually researched and documented Uncle Billy's entire boxing career, every professional bout, 76 in all, spanning 7 years, the vast majority against local opponents in Syracuse, but also at the Gaiety Theater in Wilkes-Barre, Laurel Garden in Newark, the Forum in Montreal, and twice in 1927 on the undercard at Madison Square Garden in New York. Keep in mind that next to baseball, boxing was probably the most popular sport in America at that time. The names of some of Billy's welterweight opponents can set a curious mind reeling. Johnny Haystack, Frisco McGale, Winnipeg Jack O'Brien, all flesh and blood with plenty of blood. No, I wouldn't have been comfortable watching you practice your craft, Billy. But I'm very proud to share the story that lay beyond that photograph, much less beyond that punchline.
Don't be a stranger if you're looking for a friend. If you want an even break, you've got to learn to bend. You don't have a song if you don't know how to sing. You don't have a prayer if you don't know how to dream. Now what's the use in dying if you don't die trying? If you don't die trying, what's the use? What's the use in flying if you don't die flying? If you don't die flying, what's the use? If you're gonna roll the dice, you gotta take a chance. You gotta get out on the floor if you wanna do the dance. If you don't know how to laugh, you'll never learn to cry. If you don't know how to fall, you will never learn to fly. What's the use in dying if you don't die trying? Don't die trying, what's the use? What's the use in flying if you don't die flying? If you don't die flying, what's the use? What's the use in dying if you don't die trying? If you don't die trying, what's the use? Thank you.
Even with all the discipline that's involved, there can be a genuine feeling of freedom that accompanies personal practice. Beyond expanding your capacity, this practice hopefully will involve a measure of choice. Perhaps you've been present when a child's aptitude or innate interest first leads them on a journey of discovery. That is truly a privilege to witness, much less encourage. There are certain practices that will invite someone with far more life experience. Once again, you'll find yourself at the intersection of curiosity and forgiveness. Surprised when you embrace an activity long after you thought you'd made up your mind about it. Surprising yourself is a wonderful practice all in itself. Being scared or self-conscious with the unfamiliar is inevitably part of growing up. As a mature adult, you might find it exhilarating to remember how that feels. Among the stray tasks I learned after I first left my parents' home was the ability to make pancakes from scratch. I acquired the recipe and the skill during a summer job in a hotel kitchen. This meant I made pancakes for total strangers before trying them out on friends or loved ones. I believe this would have proven to be a real advantage had I not abandoned the practice entirely after that one summer. Perhaps you've heard about the concept of the first pancake. That's the one you eat at the stove, either because it didn't turn out quite right or because you wanted to test the prototype before it went public. A personal practice is, by definition, yours to remember, yours to modify, and yours to share, which makes my excuse for stepping away from this acquired skill all the more ironic. I became convinced there was just too much preparation and cleanup to justify making a short stack of flapjacks for myself. But recently, I fired up the griddle and rekindled my interest. One difference now involves the meaning of that first pancake. Instead of representing forgiveness or fear, that trial and error has become a long-held tradition, a ritual of sorts. Oh, I always like to reserve that first one for myself. Pure superstition, or just another step in the process. Rituals are a type of practice all by themselves. I found both of them tend to age well. Parting word here to Tallulah Bankhead. Quote, "Here's a rule I recommend. Never practice two vices at once." And so, next time.
Love is lovelier the second time around. Just as wonderful with both feet on the ground. It's that second time you hear your love song sung. It makes you think, perhaps, that love like youth is wasted on the young. Love's more comfortable the second time you fall. Like a friendly home the second time you call. Who can say what led us to this miracle we found? There are those who bet love comes but once, and yet I'm oh so glad we met the second time around. Thank you. what led us to this miracle we found. There are those who bet love comes but once, and yet I'm very glad we met the second time around.
We're closed.
You've been cooking at this hour?
Just cleaning up.
Oh. Have you forgotten your old friend?
I told you we were closed.
I'm Hank Quinlan.
I didn't recognize you. You should lay out those candy bars.
It's either the candy or the hooch. Must say, I wish it was your chili I was getting fat on. Anyway, you're sure looking good.
You're a mess, honey.
Yeah.
Porchlight is engineered by our radio audio director, Mike Pascash, production assistance from Luann Johnson. Our executive producer is John Bailey. At wfiu.org/porchlight, you will find commentary, postcard images, and an archive of every episode.